My sobriety date is May 9th, 1993. That's the day that God came between me and booze, separated me from alcohol for the last time. I didn't pick my sobriety date. If I was picking sobriety dates, it probably would have been Thanksgiving morning of 1989 when I'd been in the Marine Corps about 6 months and my life was supposed to be different. I was supposed to be different. And I came home on Liberty for Thanksgiving weekend. I was supposed to be a changed person thanks to the government and the Marine Corps. And I got a DUI in just a few hours of being home, and my parents were hauling me out of the drunk tank on the morning of Thanksgiving. And that wasn't my first time in jail. That was my first time on a DUI, and that was the first time that I lost control because I took the first drink. But the pitiful incompetence with the demoralization of that incident in 1989, when I got home, was so maddening and so frustrating to me that I was on my knees praying like I'd never prayed before, making promises to God that I'd never made before, and swore that I would never ever do that again, and I didn't ever want to do that again. And that's, when I look back at that, that's probably the most willing I've ever been to not ever drink again. And when my friend called me up on the morning after Thanksgiving Day, asking if he wanted to go hang out, and I know what "you want to go hang out" means, I was drinking again. And I didn't want to do that. So if I was picking sobriety days, it would have been Thanksgiving 1989, but that's not when my sobriety day occurred. I want to welcome the newcomers that are here. I want to welcome everybody that's here. It's a really nice turnout. We have a really nice meeting hall. I'm always humbled by having the opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, it's that service side of the triangle that completes the triangle, which completes the circle. You know, that circle of completeness. It's a part of the program that gives me a real sense of purpose, a real sense of usefulness, and really a sense of completeness. Not too many things come even close to having the opportunity to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. What I was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and what I was like before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was raised in a middle class family. I went to a good church, went to had good parents. I played sports. I was a kid that everybody else's family wanted me to, you know, be over at their house and hanging out and all that other stuff. But by the time I was 9 years old, I already had this. I had this double life going on that our book talks about. And that I was consciously aware of. I was already becoming two people. At best, two people. You know, the one that I showed to my parents, the one that I showed to church on Sunday, and then the one that the authority figures in my life wanted me to be, and then this other demon child. You know. And this is before alcohol really became prevalent in my life. And at a young age, before I even started drinking, I felt like I was an only child, and I felt like a stranger in my own home by the time I was 8, 9 years old. That's not because of my parents or anything like that. It's just something that started to run around in my brain in my home. I would look at the family pictures and stuff on the wall, and I would start assessing that, you know, I really don't look like my dad. I don't really look like my mom. Maybe I don't belong here. You know, and having been raised in a pretty strict religion, and already beginning to live a life that was contrary to what I was being taught in church, by 9, 10 years old, I figured God probably didn't want nothing to do with me. I'd already been introduced to alcohol at a young age, and being a young age, I couldn't get to it. But by 9, 10, 11 years old, there's other family members, you know, extended family members that when we went to visit them, family parties and stuff, they would give it to me. So if I could get it, I was drinking it. It might as well have been soda pop, but it wasn't soda pop, you know. If I could get it, I was drinking it. By the time I was 13, I was going out and getting it. And, you know, it was for the 8th grade dance. It was for going over a friend's house and watch movies or goofing around or whatever. But I was going out and getting it. By the time I was 16 and I got a driver's license, that's when I look back at my drinking history, that's when the phenomenon of craving had really begun to kick in. That's when once I started to drink, I had no idea what was going to happen, when it was going to end, you know. But I was still enjoying alcohol. I was still experiencing the empowerment that alcohol gave me, the empowerment that alcohol gave me that I couldn't do for myself, you know. But by the time I was 18, nobody wanted to be around me. Went from Mr. Popular to Mr. Don't Come Around, you know, and I became lower companionship. And I didn't, you know, people were seeking lower companionship, but I became lower companionship. And when I turned 18, I was already beginning to puke blood, and I was already seeing the cops on a regular basis, and I was sleeping in my car or at the people's place that had what I wanted, and so they ran out. And close to turning 19, I'd been arrested so many times, a couple DUIs and stuff that we do when we're drinking, that drama that surrounds us, some of our drinking, not everybody, surrounds our drinking. Started giving me the idea that I better get out of town or else I was going to do some real time. And so I thought I could start going, and I started trying to get into the Marine Corps. And it took me 3 tries to get into the Marine Corps because I would have these going away parties and I'd get arrested. And so I'd always miss my shift date, you know. After about a year and a half of that, and the drinking's completely out of control, it's 3 or 4 years now. It's been, like Bill describes, continuing all day and almost every night. You know, if my eyes are open, I'm drinking. Unless my body is shut down or the cops lock me up or I'm in an emergency room or something like that. That's the only way that I get stopped, you know. And so anyway, so these things are starting to happen. And the last time I had been arrested, I went before the court. And the recruiter spoke on my behalf and encouraged the judge to give me one more chance. But the judge said, you know, you either get out and go in the Marine Corps in the next week or two, or you're going to go do a year with me. And you know, he asked me what it's going to be, and figuring I was too sexy for jail, at 135 pounds and 5'7", I figured I would go to the Marine Corps, right, where maybe sexiness isn't such a factor. And so I went in the Marine Corps, and I really had a lot of hope for going in the Marine Corps, maybe, you know, changing my life and everything. And, you know, that was my geographical, was to go in the Marine Corps. And so by 20, long story short, at 22 years old, and a lot of wreckage, no relationship with my parents, couldn't stand the person I had become when I looked at myself in the mirror. I was committed for alcoholic insanity at 22 years old, and I was locked down in a 4-point restraint at Triple Army Medical Center. I spent 8 days in the psychiatric ward, and with all the psychiatrists, and alcoholism specialists poking and prodding me, and you know, figuring out what my problem was, and they're dancing around everything except for alcoholism. And even though I was there because of an alcohol-related incident, they were dancing around that, and they were doing the best they could. And after 8 days and 40 stitches in my head, and I still had the wristband, my Marine Corps buddies came to pick me up and pat me on the back, and we were going to go go get dinner and have, you know, right after them. And we went to go have dinner, and we had to wait in a bar. And the waitress came around, and I'm a little antsy. I want to drink bad. And I can't drink just a couple hours coming out of the psychiatric ward, can I? You know? That would look really bad, you know? And that lady came around, and I'm telling myself on the inside, you know, in my head, that just say Coke, you know, just say Coke when she comes by. And when she came by, she came by, and I said, I'll have a Bud Lunch, you know? And that started a 30-day run, and it ended in getting locked down in the same place for 8 weeks. For 8 weeks in that shoot facility in the psych ward, actually, I started going. They took me through all kinds of intensive psychotherapy, and introduced me to other AA meetings that I hadn't been to yet. I was treated for inner child. I was treated for lost child. I was treated for only child. Hypnotherapy, regression therapy, past life regression therapy. You name it. They ran the speed course on me. And I began to tell them what they wanted to hear, and got my little certificate that said my brain was better. And this time it was a different story on people who picked me up. The guys that picked me up were my roommate, and my roommate had been sober 10 months, my roommate in the Marine Corps. And in that 10-month period, I really could care less what he was doing. You know, it was, when I saw him, it was just like that scenario we read about in Bill's story when Evie first comes over to see Bill, and Bill's got the gin on the table, right? Every time my roommate was coming in, that was my attitude, you know, and he's sober, I'm not. Stay sober, I'm not. You know, and the two won't meet. But anyway, him and the guy that would become my sponsor, which was also his sponsor, they picked me up. You know, the interesting thing about all that is I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous by those guys on the first trip in the psychiatric ward. It wasn't in a meeting. Those guys were out there doing their job. They were doing their 12-step work. They weren't part of an H&I committee. They were following the instructions on page 89 of where they can go to find newcomers. Because they couldn't help themselves to not do it because of an experience that they had and an experience I've had the opportunity to have as a result of these steps. And they went to a place where they could find people that were sick and suffering from alcoholism. They didn't come up there for me specifically. It's just something they did every Sunday. And I just so happened to be there. I hadn't even made the blotter yet, you know, down at the base. And they did this man on the bed thing. That experience has grown in its importance the longer that I continue to stay sober and the more people that God gives me the opportunity to help. Because it was just like the people that started this program did it. It was a recovered alcoholic going to the sick alcoholic and offering this opportunity to stay sober and live a life happy, joyous, and free sober. They weren't pounding me with the book. They weren't pounding me how many meetings I had to go. They were just talking to me about alcoholism, what they were doing sober, and about AA. And the guy that ended up being my first sponsor, Will, you know, I was laying there after they got done doing their spiel. He said, I needed to get out of the bed because there was people on that alcoholic ward that were sicker than me. And we needed to go help them. And all they were doing was following directions in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? And I highly doubted that there was anybody sicker. But I just wanted to go look at the circus if there was. And so anyway, these guys came to pick me up. And we went to a restaurant. And we had to wait in the bar. And one other guy that they brought was a normie friend in our platoon, who I was good friends with. And I was gonna be the designated driver for him because he was gonna have some normal drink, you know, like a drink and a half. And we're sitting there in the bar, and Tony, my roommate, says, "You want a drink, don't you?" And I said, "I could kill one." And he said, "Well, just hand us the key." And I had that idea like in Jim's story or Fred's story, where he says, I didn't think I was being none too smart putting the whiskey into my milk. And I'm handing my keys over to Tony and going, "This probably isn't very smart." But I couldn't stop myself. I couldn't stop myself from doing that. And that experience eliminated a lot of things that I come to believe, not only in treatment, but in going to 3 meetings a day for 30 days in between trips to the psych ward, that I heard was going to work to keep me sober. And it eliminated a lot of them. It eliminated that meeting to keep me sober, number one. It eliminated a sponsor, the sponsor going to keep me sober. It eliminated intensive psychotherapy was going to keep me sober. It eliminated a lot of human ideas that I thought were going to keep me sober. Not to mention a happy, joyous, and free life. And eliminated, you know, the one-liners and the slogans that we all hear that may work for a lot of people but don't work for me. And it started to lead me down a path that if I'm an alcoholic like our big book describes, and I'm the alcoholic that is beyond human aid for sure. And they were willing to let me get a full knowledge of my condition to find that out. They were clear about their first step. Whether it was going to be that night or as soon as I got away from them, what they knew is that if I'm a real alcoholic, and I am, I'm beyond human aid, which means there's nothing that they're going to do at that moment or later down the road that's going to keep me from taking the first drink. And they're willing to let me find that out. And God brought me back to AA, and long story short, in that first year on Alcoholics Anonymous, I probably went to 1,000 meetings. I did everything but take the step. I had this thing in my back pocket of my mind that there's got to be something I can do to stay sober. There's got to be, if I just get out of the Marine Corps, there's got to be something I can do. Get my life on track. Start living a life that I always wanted to live, that I've been thinking about for 4 years in the Marine Corps. And that's what I got to do. And I had this in the back of my back pocket. I still really didn't believe that God wanted anything to do with me, which was kind of a precursor to, you know, I got to do this on my own, you know. And so in that year coming out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I never had more than 5.5 months of sobriety, even though I went to about 1,000 meetings. I was easily a 3 meeting a day guy. On the weekends, it might be 5 meetings. I was a meeting junkie. And I am, my experience is that meeting, for this alcoholic, meeting makers, being a meeting maker didn't keep me sober. You know, it's just one of the things that points you to the power that does keep me sober. But that in itself didn't keep me sober. And at 5.5 months of sobriety in AA, and I was so sick sober. I'm the alcoholic that gets sicker when he's not drinking. You know, just not drinking for me is a disaster. You know, all the defects of character, all the fear, all the resentments, all the selfishness, all that stuff just becomes intensified and becomes acute. And I'm taking actions on that stuff, it runs my life whether I drink or not. And if I'm not drinking, it just crushes me. And so I get worse. And so I just have this nasty habit of looking in the mirror at these certain plateaus of sobriety like we talk about and say, "Can you see a difference? Is there a difference? Why am I walking away from this thing every, you know, after every meeting going, what the hell's wrong with me? Why isn't it working for me? You know? Laying in my rack or laying in my bed staring at the ceiling, why isn't it working for me? It's working for all these other guys. Why isn't it working for me? You know? And I started a 10-week run that would be my last run. I swore off Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never sworn off food, but I swore off Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went on this 10-week run that I was hoping would kill me at some point. And on May 9th, 1993, no aspirations of stopping drinking. I wasn't on a jail cell floor. I wasn't in an emergency room. I hadn't rolled over my car. I hadn't made a complete ass of myself to somebody or family or what have you. Nothing really was going on. I was out of the Marine Corps for a few weeks. I was getting ready for a job interview, really. And I mean, I know what you guys do to get ready for job interviews, but that's what I was doing. And so I cracked that third beer, bring it to my lips, and I threw it in the garbage. And this what I call a void, I don't know what it was, but this thought came through, David, you're done. You're done. And it was a done like you'd never been done before. Like none of the other previous times, what I thought I was done. And that's a really good question if you're going to work with other alcoholics. Ask them, are you done? If they're not sure, my experience is that probably not. Are you done? You know? And I was done, whether I liked it or not. And all of a sudden, my car was pointed to a meeting I'd been to somewhere on leave time in between stays in the Black Cancer Court. A place I swore I'd never be. I'm in this new meeting, on time. And I wait for a guy that I remember. And after that meeting, I asked him to be my sponsor, which is another thing I swore I'd never, ever do. And when I start to realize is that something happened in my sobriety days that was completely driving me that I didn't consent to, didn't ask for, and doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I'm an alcoholic that suffers from the phenomenon of craving. It is beyond my mental control to stop drinking. How did I get a sobriety date? Is it possible that God would intervene for a guy like me and say, you're done, David. I don't care whether you like it or not. I got something for you to do. I'm powerless once I start. I have no idea when I'm going to stop. How did I get a sobriety date? And so this is a very powerful experience. And I'd like to say I jumped right into the steps, and I didn't. I took the other tack that you read about in family afterward, where the husband will take one of two tacks after having this sober experience, and that is go off into money or go off into spirituality. And I went chasing that picture I'd been thinking about for 4 years in the Marine Corps. And I started building this kingdom around me that I thought would be conducive to not, you know, liking who I was and liking my life and feeling good about myself, and therefore I'm not going to drink again. And so I'm making more money than I ever made. And I got the pad, I got the her, and got the car, I got the bank account, and all this other stuff. And everything was going pretty good. And at 14 months sobriety, I was ready to blow my brains out. And I couldn't figure out why. And thank God for good sponsorship. Because they took me to a place and talked about, in We Agnostics, about how alcoholics sometimes get to a place, setting aside the drink question, and be able to tell you why their life is so unsatisfactory. I'm 14 months sober. I'm going to AA. I'm doing all this stuff, and it's really great. And I want to die. Worse than I ever did drinking. You know? And that drove me, I went to my sponsor, and I was scared to death. I was equally afraid of what was going to happen if I drank again as I was if I stayed sober another day the way I was staying sober. I was equally afraid. And I became desperate. And one of the things that we talked about with my sponsor right away was not only that my sobriety date was potentially God-given, which I know to be true today. But that in spite of the way I lived my life for that 14 months of sobriety, I'm a guy that has no mental defense against the first drink. I'm a guy that drinks under any emotional condition. It doesn't make a difference. Feeling good, feeling bad, feeling nothing, not wanting to feel anything. I drink under any condition. So how I feel has nothing to do with whether I drink alcohol again. What I'm thinking about has nothing to do with whether I drink alcohol again or not. And he said, how have you been able to stay sober? Is it possible, he asked me, that the grace of the God that you're not willing to believe in, or that you're not willing to believe, believes in you, has not only given you a sobriety date, but has given you the power to keep it whether you like it or not, in spite of yourself. And he asked me, are you willing to stop seeing God in the rearview mirror and start finding out about this God that's given you sobriety and start getting a conscious contact? Are you willing to start doing that and get free? And not just not drink, but really have a life that our program of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about. And I was desperate. Like I'd never been desperate before. Okay. Okay. And so we went through the second and third step in just a few hours. And we hit some points. We talked about old ideas about God that I was using as blocks to coming to believe what God really means to me, what God honestly means to me, like our book talks about, you know, and my prejudices and ideas about God that I avoided, and ideas of God that I cast aside that made me feel like God didn't want nothing to do with me. All these old ideas about God that were getting in the way of finding out what God really means to me. And I was asked to set that all aside and then ask what the book says in prayer and meditation, God, what do you want from me? And trust that I'm going to get an answer. And I started to build a real faith, a real relationship, started to build a real relationship, which is exactly what I needed, to a point that I was willing to make that third step decision. To see my relationship with God as a father-child, as a director-actor, as the principal and the agent. Because drunk or sober, without that, I'm going to die from alcoholism. Alcoholism is what I'm left with when I'm sober. Alcoholism isn't me taking a bottle and drinking everything in it. Alcoholism is what I'm left with. And alcoholism demands to be treated. And it's either going to be treated by another drink, a higher power, or an alcoholic death. You know? And so our book describes that our trouble is rooted in selfishness and self-centeredness. My alcoholism is rooted in selfishness and self-centeredness. It's driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. That means that the roots are sitting in a soil that has the nutrients of 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And unlike treatment, and unlike the psychiatrist that talked to me for 8 weeks ad infinitum, the book doesn't equate fear with an emotion. It equates fear with evil. Okay? A spiritual malady. And the book will finally come right out and flat out tell us in the fourth step that we're spiritually sick. And once we straighten out spiritually, we straighten out mentally and physically. It doesn't happen in the reverse. As much as I try to do it in the reverse. And that alcoholism, selfishness, resentment, does not care whether I drink alcohol again or not. It doesn't need alcohol to take me down the path of an alcoholic death. Doesn't need it. If you've been around AA for a little while, we all know people that have been sober and blown their brains out. Sober a long time and blown their brains out. That's an alcoholic death. That's an alcoholic death. I want to be that guy. But I don't have the power to keep from being that guy. And so I got to make this decision, to make that commitment with the prayer, you know? And we went into the fourth step. My first fourth step, I wrote in about 5 days. And that following weekend, we were fifth stepping. had an 8-step list on Sunday morning. So 10 days I had an 8-step list. And I got off my knees in that 7-step prayer, made that 8-step list, left my sponsor's house. And I didn't know what was different, but something was different. That hate for the world and everybody in it kind of went away. I literally had that kind of hate for everybody in the world, and kind of went away. I jumped right into a men's. I had about 125 men's, and it took about 6 weeks, and I was to get about 75 of those 125 done. I'm a guy that came out of an asylum, and for 2.5 years on Alcoholics Anonymous, heavily involved in meetings, did not change except for get sick. Until I jumped into the spiritual solution. Six weeks into these amends, it was clear to me that this obsession of when I was going to take the drink again was gone. And it hasn't returned since in 15 years under any condition. And I'm not so special. This is what's promised by the people that went before. Find out. You know? I went and made amends to the company I was working for, and I thought they were going to fire me, and they wanted to promote me. I went and made amends to the school I got kicked out of, and to make it right, they said, you're going to show up when in health class every semester when we're talking about drug and alcohol addiction, and you're going to show up in driver's ed when we're talking about drunk driving, and you're going to tell your story. That's how you're going to make it right. Okay. 6 months later, they go, you want to coach soccer here? A guy like me doesn't coach soccer at high school. I can't get from where I was to there on my own power. About 6 months into coaching soccer, parents are coming up to me and says, you know, you're a better influence on our kids than half the teachers. I wasn't looking for that. You know? That's the result of doing the steps, seeking God, and becoming a changed person. I couldn't make those changes on my own. You know? And this whole process from the inventory to the amends, there was this sense of forgiveness that continued to build. You know, the book doesn't talk a lot about forgiveness specifically, but those of you that know that have gone through this work and done it know, start getting a sense of forgiveness. And in that inventory, I began to really forgive the people that I was so angry with, so resentful towards, the people that I thought hurt, threatened, and interfered with my life. Why? Because I saw that I was no different than they were. I saw that I'd done the same things to them as I'd done to and done to other people more than once. And if I'm spiritually sick, perhaps they're spiritually sick, could they have done anything different than what they did? I couldn't. And I start getting a sense of forgiveness for the people that I was mad at. And this is a sense of forgiveness I tried to make happen on my own. And couldn't make happen. And I start, I come out of this fifth step, and it talks about the nearness of our Creator, that peace of mind. And I begin to realize that God forgave me a long time ago for what I've done. And I've done things that I thought I would never escape from spiritually. You know, in the 12 and 12, in the 6th step, Bill Wilson talks about the 7 deadly sins. He talks about, he ends it by talking about most of us do not go to these rock bottom levels. I read that like a checklist. That's not a yes for me. I read that, I can't get A that way. Everything in there I've done except one, more than one. And you come that background of a particular religious point of view, you come in thinking God doesn't want nothing to do with you, and you find out He's always wanted something to do with you. And He's got something for you to do. And He forgave me long before I ever considered it. And then when I start making amends, the last part of the amends, just like the book says, will you forgive me? and either do or they don't, right? And then you're sitting there with somebody in the 12th step, and you're talking about the same thing that you inventoried, the same thing you just said, the same thing you made me for, right? And you stress not only the forgiveness for yourself, but the forgiveness for the person you're helping. And it comes full circle. You know? And none of that could I have come up with on my own. I'm not that kind of guy naturally of my own accord. And, the 10th step and the 11th step are critical. They're not just maintenance steps. Book talks about this is how we grow in understanding and effectiveness and in this realm of the Spirit. I've got past the point of one to be Mr. AA. I have my doubts with that. I don't have any aspirations of being the best speaker in AA. I don't have anything going on like that. I don't care about being popular anymore. All I care about really is growing understanding and effectiveness. And the best way I found that to happen is by being diligent in the daily disciplines of steps 10 and 11. You know? Because I get the opportunity to sponsor a lot of people, and I get recently in the last 5 or 6 years I've had the opportunity to sponsor a lot of people that have been around AA and they've been sober and they're ready to blow their brains up. One of the first things we talk about is, tell me about your 11th step. And they don't know what one is because they've never done one. They talk about it a lot, but they've never actually followed the 11th step out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and found the benefit of doing that on a daily basis. Then I talk to them about, tell me about your 8th step list and is it done? And I would say that 9 out of 10 people, it's not done. It's not done. But they've been going around Alcoholics Anonymous claiming to have had a spiritual awakening as a result of the 12 steps, when the truth is that they've had a spiritual awakening as a result of 7 steps or 8 steps in a few minutes. And that's a real delusion, to think that I'm going to be in the same place in my relationship with God, with the men still hanging out there, as I would be clear of my amends operating 10, 11, and 12. It's a real delusion. The power's not the same. If I'm in the same universe, you know, get into that. You know, and the 12th step, like I mentioned before, you know, when I got started, was that to me is where I get the opportunity to feel the most whole. You know? Get to a place where you can carry a message about Alcoholics Anonymous as outlined in the book. This is what created a 92% recovery rate in Cleveland. Okay? 80% in Akron. Okay? We don't have anything like that today. I've had the opportunity to sponsor about 50 people over the last 15 years. And, I mean, that have gone through at least up to 9. And I think 5 have drank. And that's not about me. That's about following this direction in the book, inviting God in and following the direction. So the numbers are still the same if we follow this. Be careful with the majority that's telling you that there's many ways to do the program and there are people sitting in it, because 95% of people aren't staying sober 5 years. And if alcohol did to you what it did to me, drinking 5 years down the road is no good. It's no good. It's got to be forever. It's got to be that commitment that the book asked me to make. Not that I can pull off, but asked me to make. Are you willing to stay sober? Take every necessary step to stay sober forever. For good and all together. Period. If I'm staying sober on one day at a time, I still have a reservation about tomorrow. Get into place, follow the directions, unify on the message. Unify on the message. That's what we unify on. And get in a place where you can be in the service of carrying the result of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous to another alcoholic. And you'll have a complete triangle. And what that triangle represents when it's complete, an equilateral triangle, is what the circle tells us, and that's completeness, wholeness. Get in a place where you're sitting across the table from somebody and you're experiencing all three parts of that program at the same time, all three parts of that triangle, and tell me that's not the most whole you'll ever feel. That's where the magic is. That's where the work, the self-sacrifice is. That's where that magic is, you know? And for 15 years, I can't help myself from doing that. And I'll shut up with this. We are given an immense gift here. You are given the opportunity in the fourth step, in the fear inventory, to find out what God would have you be. Do you have any interest in that at all? I can tell you that alcoholism has an interest in you not finding that, for a fact. Stop seeking God, spiritual malady, alcoholism is going to roll right over the top of you. It doesn't care what you believe about God. God is either everything or it's nothing. When it becomes finite, alcoholism just rolls right over the top of you. You know? Get to that place where you can carry that message. You know, find out what God would have you be. Ask God to give you some ideal to live your life by so you can become what he'd have you be, which is the sex part of the inventory. It's not about sex, it's about our relationships. You know, find out. Find what this book talks about where you can get to a place and actually hear what God's will is for you. You don't need a middleman. You can find out here. Find out what God had to be. And find out that you really do have the key to life and happiness for another alcoholic. That God has given you that power as a result of doing this program. Life and happiness for another alcoholic. The power to help them avert death and misery. That is real power. Are you willing to step up and accept the responsibility that that power comes with? Okay. That's all I have. I'm shut up now. Thank you for listening.